Welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast from the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Eimear Green, and today's episode features the second panel session from our virtual conference, Rising to the Challenge, Global Citizenship in 2020. We have five wonderful speakers exploring the questions, where do we go from here? How do we move forward with purpose? And if uncertainty opens up possibilities, how do we create a new normal built on equality, diversity, sustainability and human rights for all? What could that look like and how do we get there from here? I hope you enjoy.
I'm Vicky Brennan. I'm the CEO of Proudly Made in Africa. It's a role I've had for about 4 years, and I also sit on IDEA's National Council. So I am honoured to be chairing this panel today because I'm always impressed by the lineup of speakers and guests, the guests that IDEA managed to get for their events. Actually, before I introduce you to the panel, I'd like to just kind of frame what we're all going to be speaking about for the next 2 hours. So this morning we talked about where we are and how we got here. And I know some of you had questions about moving forward, and we saw that wonderful graphic capture about all of the questions and the comments that fell out from this morning. So this afternoon we're going to be talking about where do we go from here? How do we move forward with purpose? And if uncertainty has opened up possibilities, how are we going to create the new normal and build on the foundations of what we all talk about in our DE practice every day, which are equality, diversity, sustainability, and human rights for everybody? So what does that look like? And where do we go from where we're standing here? So I think we've all heard about Build Back Better, but today, in the next 2 hours, we're going to resolve that and get to really figure out what it looks like to move forward with purpose and include everybody. So, the speaker lineup. We have Wangani Grace Taolo, who is the Senior Education Advisor and on Gender Equality and Inclusion for UNICEF. She's going to be speaking about the impact of COVID-19 on the marginalised and how they need to be put at the centre of the recovery process if we are going to create a new normal and a better normal for everybody. Then after Wangani, we'll speak to Manuel Pulgar-Vidal, who is the Global Leader of Climate and Energy at WWF International and the former President of the UN Framework for Convention on Climate Change at COP20. So, a climate expert by anyone's definition. And Manuel will speak about the climate crisis and challenges and threats and the opportunities that are in front of us right now. So what we can do to create real change to tackle issues. Then we'll pass to Bulilani Mafako, an activist and spokesperson for the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland, or MASI, if you follow them on Instagram, which I do. After Bulilani, we'll pass to Mark Malone, who is a communications worker and an independent researcher into the growth of extremism and the far-right movement in Ireland. So Mark's going to speak to us about the growth of the far-right and how we can counter and challenge the narratives that that creates. And then last, but by no means least, we'll pass to Stephen McCloskey, the director of the Centre for Global Education and the editor of the biannual journal Policy and Practice, Development Education Review, which I believe has its next issue coming up in a couple of weeks. So that's our panel. I think you can agree it's a very exciting lineup, and I know you'll have tons of questions for everybody. You don't want to listen to me wittering on. So without further ado, what I'm going to do is pass you to Wangani to kick us off.
Good morning from New Jersey. Good afternoon to some of you, and good evening probably to some of you as well. I'll be talking about education, and of course the focus is on putting the most marginalized children at the core of the concept on building back better in education. I wanted to start by saying that at least from the perspective of UNICEF, we take education as a human rights issue. It is a justice issue, and we look at it as the greatest equalizer. If you put all kids in a school which is offering equal opportunities, no matter their background, that's the greatest equalizer you can have in terms of achieving the right to education. So what we have seen is the impact of COVID has actually exacerbated the inequalities that were there previously, even before COVID. We know that even before COVID, we had over a quarter of a million children out of school, most of them, of course, from sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and of course, in conflict and crisis affected countries, and also over 500,000 learners were actually not acquiring the basic minimum proficiencies required in literacy and maths. So we had a crisis before COVID, and this crisis has just been exacerbated. Throughout this crisis, we know that governments have been trying to keep learners continuing learning and continuing accessing their education. Different modalities have been used, most of which have actually relied on technology. And we have seen that most of the governments actually implemented online learning. There were some that implemented TV. There were some that implemented radio. But even with all that effort, over 463 million learners were actually not reached during this period. It means they totally missed out. And the characteristics of these learners were mostly those in rural areas, those in the most poorest communities. We had regional discrepancies, of course, sub-Saharan Africa faring the worst in that regard, but also limitations in terms of pre-primary school. That was the group of learners that were least reached in this particular period. In UNICEF, we have been trying to monitor how governments and stakeholders are planning for reopening of schools. As we are hearing, most governments are actually reopening schools, and we are trying to track what they are doing to put those most marginalized groups at the center. So while some measures are being put in place, gaps are still there. And only about 500,000 had done at least one measure to try and put the most marginalized girls into the reopening plans, meaning that we still have a significant gap there. And we know that COVID has hit girls disproportionately. We learned from Ebola, high rises in teenage pregnancy, early marriages, and without any specified targets, those girls are going to continue to fare badly in education. And UNICEF has also been engaged in advocacy to ensure inclusion and equity, and highlighting those messages in the campaigns to bring back learners to school. So we are putting efforts in investing in communication, community mobilization, and sensitization to try and make sure that those groups that are at risk of not coming back to school should actually be reached with these messages and should actually be supported to get back to school. That slide just talks to some of the measures to ensure inclusion in the different countries and also the level of preparedness. How have countries fared in terms of ensuring that critical messages reach the most marginalized populations and in the languages that they understand, including languages that are friendly to children with disabilities? How have we integrated gender-based violence, sexual reproductive health, nutrition, health, literacy, to vaccinations as we reopen schools? How have we looked at issues of mental health, psychosocial support? We know the impact that COVID has had in that regard on families, but also specific tailored campaigns to girls, out of school learners, children with disabilities, but also just to address the measures that will pose the greatest barriers in terms of enrollment, which are mostly in this case economic measures. So that graph just really talks to the significant challenges that are still there, and just a few highlights in terms of the green of countries that are actually doing well. My last slide there, what are we doing? What are we pushing for in terms of policy reforms and putting in place systems to ensure that marginalized learners actually are not left behind? We are saying you need to expand inclusive remote learning strategies. We obviously know that there's going to probably be recurrence of this pandemic, and we need to look at blended learning approaches. But in doing that, you make sure that you address the digital divide between girls and boys, between the poorest and the richest, and the rural and urban. Expand access, open beta, but also open wider by expanding access to those that were actually previously out of school before even COVID, and making sure there's flexibility in that regard. Addressing the learning crisis. Focus on foundational literacy, maths, and reading, so that at least learners can be able to catch up on the learning loss that they have actually experienced during this time when they were not participating in online learning. Equity financing. put resources where they matter most by targeting those populations that are left behind. And I've talked about these particular groups. So we're pushing governments to ensure that their finances actually target those groups. Invest in gender transformative education and analyze, have evidence, and invest in that regard. And of course, we have seen that there's a critical role for parents and caregivers that we need to include in this particular regard. So I'll stop there and hope to engage in further discussions during the Q&A and the breakaway rooms. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wangani, and thank you for paying attention to our stop-start system. Much appreciated. That was fascinating. So without further ado, I'll pass down to Manuel.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you very much. I am more than delighted to be part of this panel to bring the climate approach and to make a question, how much possible it is to keep optimism to achieve our climate objective, the planetary climate objective. So I will frame my talk in four main elements in 5 minutes. So where we are, what have we gotten, what is missing, and what should we do, no? To see if we can keep that optimism. So where we are facing a strong emergency. When we think about the climate emergency, it is for sure bigger than the pandemic emergency. That is something that we should recognize. That is something that should make us able to strengthen our action. But the concept of emergency, it is an important one. So as we are in an emergency, we should recognize the need to have urgent actions, urgent initiatives, urgent measures to raise our ambition and to recognize that, unfortunately, we are living in a very difficult political context with deniers, with polarization, still with resistance. So that is the current situation. And for sure, something important in where we are, science has told us exactly what it could happen if we don't act immediately. So that is where we are. What have we gotten? I think that in some way, and even with the pandemic, we have gotten more awareness. So the people, it is fully more aware of what it is, the climate emergency, and what it could be the consequences of don't act. So that is something important for keeping the optimism. Also, we have gotten a strong political decision. The Paris Agreement, 6 years, 5 years ago, it has been one of those great, successful in relation to good political decision. But unfortunately, we are losing hope in relation to the formal process, so we should recover that hope. We have gotten good signs and a strong engagement of different actors. So those are the elements of what we have got. But what is missing? I think that we haven't understood yet the need of a behavioral change, the need of a systemic transformation, the need to really move the world into a next phase, to rethink, as many people is talking now, to reset the planet, mostly in this post-pandemic time. So what should we do? We should act politically, and we do need to pressure our government domestically to have them put in their new NDCs or climate plans into the table, more ambitious climate plans. But not only climate plans, but also long-term strategies. We should push our government to define that 2050 vision and how are we planning to go to there. So how can we move our economies to be net zero, to be resilient, to address nature loss and to revert nature loss, at least to halt it. Because those elements of nature and climate, it is a strong importance. Second element, the economic one. We are living in a new climate economy. For sure, that is clear. And fortunately, it is happening. So we should talk with economic basis. If we don't act domestically or globally, the new climate economy is going to reject our product, is going to reject our exportation product. So the economic side, it is a key one. So we should also work and continue developing an economic narrative. The third element, it is the social one. We do need to be more active. We do need to have more activism. We do need to have more people mobilizing on the streets, demanding and claiming. Because it is the only way to overpass the deniers, the people who is resistant to promote this kind of systemic transformation. But also, we do need to develop our own climate action. because even as individuals, we are responsible of doing things to overpass this situation of climate emergency. But also we do need to integrate. And to integrate means to recognize. And fortunately, the pandemic has taught us that we don't need to connect climate with nature, with the economy, with health, and with political decision. It is the only way to think in a better 2050. And fortunately, in some way, that is happening. It is happening, and the next year is going to be an important one because we are going to take decisions in relation to climate around the COP26. We are going to take decisions around nature because we will have the new plan for biodiversity. We will take decisions around food. We will have a food summit. And we will have the World Conservation Congress. So it's going to be, I hope, a super 2021. But the only way to make that 2021 a strong one, it is by connecting dots, by working together, by integrating even in the global, but also in the domestic level. And my last point, it is we do need to continue pushing for a greening recovery. It is not happening, unfortunately. The last recovery plans have shown that they are not including sustainable actions. But to have that, we do need also to propose and to promote sustainable action, well-proofed sustainable action in relation to climate and in relation to nature. So if we are able to take these five recommendations as an individuals, I am sure that we can keep the optimism and that we will move the world toward our main objective to have a net zero economy, resilient economy, and a sustainable planet. So thank you. Thank you very much, Vicky.
Thanks so much, Manuel. That was fantastic. I found myself making a couple of notes there, which I will save for plenary. So we will now pass to Bulalani to speak to us about his experiences in direct provision and the work of MASI. Over to you, Bulalani.
Good afternoon from County Clare. I don't know where everybody is in the world, but I will be very brief. I'll try to be very brief. So, Vicky, you have a challenge there of keeping time. From the very start of the pandemic, where the movement of asylum seekers in Ireland, we started raising concerns about the way the pandemic would affect people in direct provision centres and asylum seekers in general. As you would know, that travel bans were imposed on many countries around the world, and asylum seekers literally need to travel from one place to the other in search of safety. And so that meant that a lot of people around the world couldn't leave their countries where they were persecuted. So their home countries, if they were in their home countries, it meant that people couldn't go in search of that sanctuary because the main means of traveling were shut down in many parts of the world. And so you saw number of asylum claims being lodged in the country dwindling down. It doesn't mean, of course, that people aren't being persecuted or don't need safety. They do, but it's just that they don't have the means to do so. Then the other way that the pandemic affected people is, of course, the way in which states respond to or receive asylum seekers. In Ireland, we would know that people, asylum seekers, for the last 20 years have been living in direct provision centres or surviving in direct provision centres, where you have a family of five in one tiny bedroom, a hotel bedroom, and that hotel bedroom is the only private space that they have as a family together. And every other living space would be shared with other strangers. Capacity in the centres varies from 200 to over 800 in Mosny Direct Provision Centre, which is the biggest in the country. And so you can imagine congregated setting of that nature, and you have COVID-19 having to share those intimate living spaces, it becomes very difficult. This would be a similar situation for homeless Irish people who were living in homeless family hubs, they call them. They are set up in exactly the same manner as direct provision centres, but they aren't really for long-term stays, just as direct provision centres aren't for long-term stays. But we know that from experience, asylum seekers spend a long time in direct provision, just as homeless people spend a long time living in hotels, because the Irish state has been very reluctant to build build public housing, they abdicate the responsibility to the private sector. And so the homeless crisis continues. What we have seen is a change in the way politicians think about addressing those issues. So for a lot of activists, it became apparent that all the arguments that we have been presenting were actually just needing political will in order to address the challenges that we had been identifying. So we saw people, homeless people in Dublin Regional Homeless Executive being moved into self-contained units, but we didn't see the same measure being taken to move asylum seekers, for instance, from direct provision centres into self-contained units where they wouldn't be sharing bedrooms and bathrooms and other communal spaces, so they could self-isolate when they need to and they could observe social distancing. That was not done for asylum seekers. And so we saw massive disparities in terms of how the state responded in the provision of material needs such as housing, such as welfare assistance or payments that were provided. So asylum seekers were initially excluded from getting the pandemic unemployment payment. So if you lost your job as an asylum seeker when the lockdown was imposed, you weren't entitled to claim pandemic unemployment when it was introduced. Only people who were not living in direct provision were allowed to claim that. And so you had a lot of asylum seekers being pushed onto the margins as per normal, even during the COVID-19 pandemic. They only later started to say that we would give asylum seekers the pandemic unemployment when they realized that asylum seekers weren't coming forward for testing for COVID-19, and many of the outbreaks were actually indirect provision centers. So you would remember the second wave of COVID-19 in Ireland started with meat plants and direct provision centers, where mainly migrants who would be people on the margins of Irish society actually live and work. And so in those circumstances, the COVID-19 amplified all the social exclusion, economic exclusion that we saw in terms of provision of public goods and services to people. It made it more evident, more salient, if you like, to anybody who cared enough to pay attention. And for us, the only solution to overcome that is to ensure that when we move forward from a post COVID-19 society, is that we don't leave people behind, that we don't have that kind of exclusion, that we will provide self-contained units for a certain group of people, but leaving others to their own peril. You don't, we'll provide welfare payments to one group while we exclude another group who are all directly affected by the same phenomena, which is COVID-19. It will be the same with other issues, housing issues that would have been before COVID-19. Those need to be addressed in a manner that is non-discriminatory, because poverty and diseases affects all of us. But COVID-19 shows us that much. You can't move away from COVID-19 pandemic without ensuring that everybody in Ireland is provided with material needs, all the material needs that they would need. For instance, your parents who are in direct provision having to homeschool their children. How do you begin to homeschool your children in one bedroom when that one bedroom is the only space that you have as a family? Where is the classroom? Where is the play space? Where is how do you start having a class when other people in the same room aren't in class? Where do you start with class when you don't have a laptop? You can't even afford one. You're getting paid 38.80 euro per week, an allowance. Where do you get a laptop with that amount of money? And so what COVID-19 has shown us is that there are solutions to all the problems that we have faced, and they only require the political will in order to change them, to address them. And that sadly does not happen without changing the narrative, the dominant narrative in public policy discourse. So when a lot of people propose solutions that are inclusive, a lot of the narrative tends to be, no, it's going to be expensive to provide all of these things to everybody else. But COVID-19 tells us that actually it's more costly not to provide public services, public goods and services in an equitable manner to all people in the state. And so for the movement of asylum seekers, the lessons we've learned in during the pandemic is that all our struggles matter. Wherever we may be, whether you are a traveler, whether you are a an asylum seeker, or whether you are a person from Roma descent, all our pains matter, and all of us are worthy of having that right to dignity and right to equality and equity. But when all of our lives are precious and are cherished, it becomes are seen as precious and cherished. It becomes easier then to make public policies that are inclusive. When you don't value the other life,
thank you, Bolalani.
You're not going to make those policies. Thanks.
Thank you. That was fascinating, as have been Manuel and Wangani's contributions. I'm sensing a bit of a theme here. Manuel, you talked about connecting the dots. Wangani, you talked about effective policy. And Bolalani, you're talking about solutions under our noses. What's lacking is political will. So I think back to Manuel's point, this is how we move forward. We act politically and socially. We get out on the streets and start demanding and taking. Very interesting. I think it's going to take us into very nice discussions in the breakout. I'm now going to pass to Mark Malone.
Thanks a million. It's very humbled actually to be speaking with such a really strong and eloquent kind of voices. The question, I guess, right, in terms of like how do we move forward in the times of uncertainty and, you know, the possibilities that are opened up, I kind of come at it in a way with like trying to think through, I guess, my work as a communications officer with COLOV, some of the work that I'm doing around monitoring the far right, and then more work kind of more historically around kind of anti-war. And so I'm not really looking at this stuff through the lens of kind of issues. And I guess what I landed on, I guess, is the idea of like the usefulness in having coordinates in terms of moving forward. Like, so how do we think about how we move forward from where we are? And two kind of coordinates, I guess, that I kind of come down on, I guess, is coordinates of radical doubt and militant hope. And I guess they're kind of just conceptual tools to help think through, I guess, the bit of like some of that conversation from where we're at, how do we get to where we are already, and then where do we go to, you know? And I think it's useful to say that these kind of concepts of radical doubt and militant hope, they can speak to us at the levels of the individual, they speak to us at the levels of our kind of campaigns, particular struggles, and also speak to us about the type of society based in social justice and equality that we want to have. And I guess in unpacking radical doubt, I kind of come at that as a way of like, how do we position and come to a sense of where we're at already now? And I think that was a large portion of the conversation this morning, kind of looking at the historical trajectories, the kind of current power dynamics that sustain inequality and injustice. Another bit of radical doubt, I guess, is like questioning the official narratives and underlying assumptions that underpin kind of systemic injustice and inequality. And much of that knowing is already out there, but a lot of the time, perhaps, it's not articulated very clearly. Or there's tensions around actually how are we able to articulate the structures of politics and the structures of economics, the human decision-making structures and infrastructures that are there. And so radical doubt, I guess, is a way of positioning ourselves that says, well, actually, it's important to challenge official narratives and challenge meaning-making. And at the core, all struggles for social justice contain elements of like change in common sense. So there's a bit of like, sort of radical doubt, kind of interrogating the narratives and structures of power structures that fuel that kind of human decision-making. And another bit of radical doubt, I guess, is like, you know, coming can situate within ourselves and situate within our organizations. And it kind of means embracing and sitting with some uncomfortableness as individuals, as movements, and as institutions and organizations. And as someone who works in the professional NGO sector, how do we kind of hold the good work that we're doing around education, around literacy, around social justice and equality, around empowerment, and very definite, meaningful social change? How do we hold on to that, yet at the same time, kind of hold on to the possibilities that some of our work is actually enabling and complicit in sustaining actual structures of inequality themselves? And Yeah, I guess what's in that is it's about opening ourselves up to asking those kind of questions. It also kind of asks us to query like the truths and promises that no longer hold. So, for example, the narratives that capitalism as it exists, or, you know, representative democracy as we have right now, inherently means everyone lives a healthier and better life and trickle-down economics. Does that really exist? Is that true? How do we question that? How do we understand perhaps the relationship between racism, patriarchy, capitalism? It means kind of questioning the assumptions of technological transformation and around communication technology that are sold to us, I guess, as essentially and intrinsically forces for good, but actually are they? And it also kind of means bringing a kind of critical lens to, allows us a space to bring critical lens to older theories of change. You know, and what can we learn from previous struggles, but also what might we need to change in coming at that, you know? And that's a kind of situational kind of, it allows us to kind of situate ourselves in the midst of the problems, in the midst of like structural global inequalities. And then I guess the second coordinate is militant hope. Militant hope, I guess, really is about, it's not really about a kind of directionless positivity. It's about being able to speak and make demands around the types of changes that we want to have. Kind of militant hope kind of speaks to the unknown and unrealized potentials that are there and social possibilities. And that can speak at the level, again, of the individual, of movements and societal level. And generally, and I think like people have kind of touched on this before, like hope is hard. Hope, like in the spaces that we're in right now, is hard individually, it can be hard institutionally, it can be hard organizationally. But I think kind of adopting a militant hope, it also situates and describes hope as a responsibility. And it's something that we should seek to reproduce continually within our movements and within ourselves. And it's also militant in the sense that it asks for accountability from ourselves and from our movements. And I think there's a bit of like of situating kind of that militancy, not from a machismo approach, which kind of militancy is often described. I think I like to describe it kind of as militant because it's actually very hard to get up day in, day out and do the work that we do. And I think sort of having a militant hope recognizes the natures of the pushbacks that come from social injustice and inequality whenever you're trying to be involved in those kind of changes. But also it's like it speaks to a kind of consistency of authenticity in the face of injustice and inequality. It speaks to regularly turning up with care and solidarity. And there's a kind of, I think there's a usefulness in placing and naming that as a militant a political position and social position.
Thank you so much, Mark. I love that concept of militant hope, the idea that hope is a responsibility rather than a feeling. And I fully agree. I feel like militant hope is something that maybe millennials will be getting tattooed on their inner arm for years to come. It'll drive us forward. So thank you. Thank you again for that, Mark. Stephen, last but by no means least, let's pass to you for the final presentation.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you very much. I have a couple of challenges for the conference based on yesterday's presentation by keynote speaker Philip Alston. The first image you have up there at the moment is about a strike that started the year up here in the north of Ireland when 9,000 nurses from the Royal College of Nurses went on strike because their wages had effectively depreciated by about 15% as a result of the last decade of austerity that followed the global financial crisis. And this has been caused by the neoliberal model of development, which Philip Alston talked about so eloquently yesterday. So everything had increased up here for nurses, food, utilities, clothing, rent, and so on. But their wages had stayed the same. So basically, their wages had decreased in value. And this, to me, was an example of how our society was broken, our economy was broken, because we started to devalue highly prized professions like nursing, which we've discovered during COVID-19 have been absolutely essential to us surviving the pandemic and getting through from one day to the next. And then another story emerged over the summer, and that's on the second slide, Elaine, about the world's richest person, Jeff Bezos, who I'm sure many of you will be familiar with. The story was that he increased his fortune, his personal fortune, by 13 billion in just one day because there was a surge in the share price of Amazon because so many people were shopping online during lockdown. So under the neoliberal economic system that's dominated and driven development over the last 40 years, we've seen these wealth extremities. On the one hand, billionaires like Jeff Bezos and 2,000 billionaires control as much wealth apparently as 4.6 billion people. And on the other hand, nurses who are becoming devalued and treated really with contempt by the global economic system. And when I thought about this as a development educator, I thought that our sector doesn't really talk about neoliberalism as part of our practice. It's really cast into the margins. It's not really central to what we do. It's not central to the work that we do with learners. And so the first challenge I want to toss out to the conference is to ask is whether we can bring neoliberalism and the whole debate around that more centrally into the discourse that we have with each other and also into the discourse and the practice that we have with learners so that we're talking about the impact of neoliberalism on society and the impact that it has on each other. I'm concerned as a development educator that the sustainable development goals in which we seem to be so heavily invested don't have the capacity and haven't been designed to address the question of neoliberalism. In fact, they seem to be complicit with the same pro-growth, pro-neoliberal, pro-GDP model of development that has created the problems that the SDGs themselves are trying to fix. So because the SDGs don't have this capacity to address the root cause of problems, they're going to be unable to address the question of neoliberalism. And this was borne out, I think, yesterday in the presentation by Philip Alston. So my second challenge to the conference is, could we have an honest conversation about the capacity of the goals to deliver on their objectives? Because I'm concerned on the one hand that the goals are calling for economic growth. For example, goal 8 talks about sustainable economic growth, and target 8.1 encourages the least developed countries to increase GDP by 7% by 2030. How is that target consistent with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial average as called for by the IPCC? So in short, on the one hand, we're not talking about the source of all of our social and economic ills, which is neoliberalism. That's not central to the practice and the discourse of development education, as far as I can see. And on the other hand, we seem to be overinvested in the success of the SDGs, even though, as Philip Alston made clear yesterday, it's very unlikely that the goals are going to be met. And the methodology, the approach to development underpinning the goals is deeply flawed.
So look, thank you very much for that presentation. I think for anyone who heard Philip Alston speak yesterday, the points that you've raised are like, I suppose, a very succinct wrap-up of the ideas that Alston proposed yesterday. The idea of naming neoliberalism, how can we, as Manuel said earlier, how can we act politically if we as development educators aren't speaking politically and addressing the question of neoliberalism? That's super point, if I may say so myself.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to check out our website for more. Until the next time.